in the forecast Sunday night. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill. It's 10 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition with special coverage of the 20th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. I'm Scott Simon. New York City firefighter John Fila had taken his children to school that morning when he heard the news and rushed to his firehouse.
We got our gear. We went out into 8th Avenue, which is a street in front of the firehouse, and we stopped the first city bus we saw as we were heading down the West Side Highway. The second tower was just coming down.
This hour, the story of the shift of firefighters who never came home, including a woman who lost her husband and her father-in-law on that same horrifying morning. Also, is the U.S. safer from attacks today, and what are the biggest threats? And how the events of September 11th affected American Muslims. Those stories and our live coverage of memorial events all are coming up. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, September 11th, 2021.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. In New York City this morning, a crowd has gathered at the site where the Twin Towers once stood to remember loved ones who died 20 years ago today during the September 11th attacks. Mike Lowe was among them. He lost his daughter on 9/11. She was an attendant on the hijacked Flight 11 that was deliberately flown into the North Tower at the start of the attacks.
Today, this is a quiet place of memory. The gleaming 9/11 Museum holds a sacred repository for our loved ones' remains.
Janine Wallace's father, Robert, died at the Twin Towers. He was a New York City firefighter whose remains are among those that have not been identified. Wallace says it's been difficult, but that the family has purchased a stone in a nearby cemetery to honor his life and provide a place for her and her siblings to grieve.
We get to go over there if we want and sit and have lunch sometimes. And but it's not the same, you know, to not have that something to say, hey, he was here.
President Biden spent the night in New York City and arrived at the ceremony shortly before it got underway. He is not scheduled to speak, but in a video message released by the White House last night, Biden called on Americans to set aside their differences and reclaim the unity that emerged in the days that followed the attacks.
To me, that's the central lesson of September 11th, is that at our most vulnerable, in the push and pull of all that makes us human, in the battle for the soul of America, unity is our greatest strength.
The president is to join the commemorations early this afternoon in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and later at the Pentagon. Vice President Kamala Harris is at the remembrance ceremony at the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The ceremony is closed to the public due to coronavirus concerns. Passengers on that flight fought with the terrorists who had hijacked the plane. Julia Agos from member station WITF in Harrisburg reports that several other high-profile former and current public officials are there for the ceremony.
Former President George W. Bush is slated to speak at the commemoration honoring those who died in Somerset County. Vice President Kamala Harris and Interior Secretary Deb Haaland will also be there. In the past, the ceremony has drawn as many as 1,000 people to the site. But like last year, it'll be a more private affair, attended mostly by family members. The service will include the reading of the names of the 40 passengers and crew members, concluding at 10:03 a.m., the time on September 11th, 2001, when the plane crashed in a reclaimed strip mine. President Joe Biden is expected to visit all three sites of the attacks. He'll travel to Shanksville later in the day. For NPR News, I'm Julia Agos in Harrisburg.
And this is NPR News. To Kentucky now, where hospitals continue to struggle with surges of COVID-19 patients. The Kentucky National Guard has been assisting the state throughout the pandemic and now providing support to 25 hospitals. As Corinne Boyer of member station WEKU reports, one Eastern Kentucky hospital is now treating COVID-19 patients at home.
In Moorhead, Kentucky, St. Clair Regional Medical Center is at 140% capacity. Some COVID-19 patients are receiving monoclonal antibody therapies in a tent in the parking lot. Because the hospital is full, teams of doctors, nurses, and respiratory therapists are caring for people at home. Here's hospital CEO Donald Lloyd.
We call it COVID care at home. While those patients are acutely ill, We're providing oxygen therapy to them in their homes.
Floyd says the medical team has tended to as many as 75 COVID patients at home. He's also pleading with his community to get vaccinated. For NPR News, I'm Corinne Boyer in Moorhead, Kentucky.
Pope Francis is set to make his first foreign trip since undergoing intestinal surgery in July. He's to kick off the trip in Hungary tomorrow to close an international church meeting before moving on to Slovakia. Francis is to meet with Hungarian President Viktor Orban, but he's only planning to spend about 7 hours in Hungary. Organizers of the trip say the Pope is not snubbing Hungary, but Francis has often denounced nationalist and populist movements and has called for European unity. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Good morning, it's 10:06. Radio Catskill, you are listening to special coverage from NPR of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. There is a special ceremony of remembrance in the town of Delaware underway now at the Calicoon Creek Park. And the Beach Lake Volunteer Fire Department is hosting their 100th anniversary with a parade and festival at 1033 Beach Lake Highway. It's also the 91st Firemen's Federation Convention. It's 10:06.
This is our memorial wall of the Pride of Midtown, Engine Company 54, Ladder 4, Battalion 9. Battalion Chief Ed Garrity, Captain Dave Woolley, Lieutenant Dan O'Callaghan.
Engine's going out.
15 firefighters from this firehouse, the entire shift, answered the bell when the first plane struck the first of the Twin Towers, 8:46 a.m., September 11th, 2001. None of them came back.
Firefighter Sam Otis, Firefighter Carl Asaro, Firefighter Alan Feinberg.
The firehouse still sits just off Broadway, on a block with a diner, shops that sell small souvenir statues of Liberty and T-shirts, a bar and a grill, and these days, lots of shuttered storefronts.
Firefighter Michael Lynch, Firefighter Jose Guadalupe, Firefighter Leonard Rigaglia.
This memorial is on a wall of the firehouse. No photos allowed, with the portraits of those who died hang just across from where today's firefighters hang their heavy black waterproof coats. John Fila is a member of Engine 54, Ladder 4, Battalion 9, just as he was 20 years ago today.
On September 11th, I was actually scheduled to work, but I had switched shifts, which was a very common thing within the fire department. I had taken my children to school, and I heard on the radio that, you know, there was a plane crash in the city. And then one of my friends called and says, it's a lot bigger than just a plane crash. And at that time, I just got in my car and headed into the city. We got our gear. We went out into 8th Avenue, which is a street in front of the firehouse. And we stopped the first city bus we saw as we were heading down the West Side Highway. The second tower was just coming down. Everything was in the air. Ash, dust, smoke, papers. Things I remember vividly is people's papers from their desks just floating down out of the air.
You knew that people you knew were inside that building.
Yeah.
Those buildings, didn't you?
You know, in this job, you know that you're responding into this, and you know that the guys that were working, and you know what they were doing. They were going inside to try to save people. That's what we do. And to know that our guys were in there and they were doing theirs, and we felt, well, we're going to go find our guys that are missing and anybody else that's there, and we're going to bring them out. And that's, you know, that was what we were focused on. As soon as we got there, we just started digging by hand, you know, and then we found buckets and whatever else you could do to try to uncover anything. Firefighter Joseph Angelini Jr., Firefighter John Tipping, Firefighter Mike Brennan.
John Fila is a stocky, sturdy-looking, gray-haired man who still pushes out the chest against his FDNY blues. We sit in the back office of the fire station where speakers crackle with fire calls from across the city and fire trucks back in with beeps. He's talked about these events a lot over the last 20 years, but his blue eyes still water.
They put their life before somebody else's life. And that is the most noble thing anyone could ever do. I talk about them because they deserve to be talked about. They did something extraordinary. People ask us now, they say, well, would you ever do the same thing again, knowing that that building could come down? And I always say, well, absolutely. I says, that's why we're here. Because we're not going to stand outside and say, oh, you know, your brother or your child is upstairs. We're going to go back in. And it's, you know, and I say, wow, that's, you know, something. I says, well, that's why we do this, because we're here to help people. We're here to be the guiding light for people to come out. And that's why I say their names all the time, because their children, their grandchildren, their neighbors, and people that have never heard of September 11th need to know what they did that day. And it's a remarkable thing. It really is.
May I ask, how are your kids?
They're great. They were 5 and 3 on September 11th. Excuse me. But I get to see him.
How are you doing?
Good. Good. I'm doing good. There were times when I wasn't doing good. I could tell you, like, a few years after that, you get frustrated sometimes, because sometimes when newer guys come in, they're not really doing the right thing as far as you're thinking what they should be as far as respectfulness towards, you know, the guys that were lost or whatever, or the job. So you become short-tempered. You come basically disassociated with a lot of things because your anger is taking over. And this is another great thing. Our fire department has a wonderful counseling unit. And I can tell you, I took advantage of it, and they talk you off the ledge. They're good.
Have you stayed in touch with families, children,
yes,
over these past 20 years?
Yep. Every year we have our little in-house ceremony on September 11th. We have a park dedicated across the street on 48th Street. So every September 11th, we have our families, you know, of all the guys that we lost, come in. And we have a breakfast here in a firehouse where we all catch up. And then we have a formal ceremony across the street. And then a lot of families will pop in and out during the year. And, I mean, one of the most fantastic things now is that we have a brother and 2 children in this firehouse whose brother and father was killed September 11th. They're actually firefighters here, which is just, you know, overwhelmingly, we're so proud. It's like, you know, Rebecca Osaro is our newest one. She was 9 on September 11th, and she's in this firehouse now. And Lenny Rigaglia, he's in here in this firehouse. And just listening to him, he sounds exactly like his father, and it's just an overwhelming sense of accomplishment and pride that their children wanted to work in the firehouse where their father and their brother worked. It's just great.
Our anniversary is hard for you?
Extremely. You know, every day we come to work, you've seen our pictures of our guys in the memorial wall. When we come to work every third day, we see that and we're reminded of it. So it's a good motivator for our young guys. It's a remembrance for us. But the actual anniversary date, I can tell you that starting in August, everybody gets a little bit more, you know, tensed up, because we know we're going to be hosting all the families, you know, on that day. And you get a little bit, you know, on edge. And this is our obligation to do, and we don't take it lightly. We take it very serious that this is our time to honor those people that were just so awesome. Firefighter Paul Gill, firefighter Michael Haub and firefighter Christopher Santoro. Those are our heroes of 54, 4 and a 9th in FDNY. Always remembered on September 11th, 2001.
Later this hour, we hear from Donna Angelini, whose husband is one of the people memorialized on that wall. My wife and I would go down to Canal Street in the days after the September 11 attacks to join in the cheers for the rescue and recovery workers heading to or from the wreckage at Ground Zero. The city had cordoned off blocks of Lower Manhattan, and the crowd in the streets around us seemed to number thousands. We saw people wave American flags, Yankees caps, and hand-lettered signs, "Our heroes, and we will never forget," and "I love New York more than ever." Another kind of crowd surrounded us, too. They were faces on sheets of paper taped up on storefronts and street lamps of people shown in photos from weddings, birthday parties, and summer barbecues, on signs that asked, "Have you seen this person? She's my wife," or "He is our father," or "She's our neighbor," all of them adding, "Last seen, morning of September 11, 2001. Please call. Please help." Trucks would pull up to the barricades carrying workers in dark, heavy emergency gear, and in the blue helmets of police, black helmets of firefighters, the yellow, white, and silver helmets of street, sanitation, and construction crews. We had probably walked right past workers like those in our daily lives. Those nights along Canal Street, we saw them. The crowds cheered and clapped as they rolled into Ground Zero to search for those few who might still be alive, and to dig out with reverent and respectful hands those many more who were now among the wreckage that smoldered there. And when their trucks rolled out after 10 and 12 hours of grueling work in a nightmare landscape, their faces looked dark, soiled, and drawn. People called out, "Thank you," and "Bless you." The 9/11 hijackers might have thought they would strike at the heart of America's financial and military power. But what we saw on those nights along Canal Street was a dazzling diversity of humanity, a living artwork of New York, of America, brought together in pain, pride, and often prayer, on a street near where the city had an aching, smoking wound. In time, the country's fissures opened back up and deepened. But my wife and I tell our children about those crowds along Canal Street, those moments in which so many saw America's astounding diversity and unity as an answer to those who struck the Twin Towers from the skyline. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Today marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Commemorations are being held in New York, the Pentagon, and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Other observances are planned around the country. The White House released a videotaped address last night in which President Biden called on Americans to set aside their differences and reclaim the unity that emerged in the days following the attacks. And the women's singles title is being decided today at the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament. 18-year-old Emma Raducanu is facing 19-year-old Leila Fernandez. It's the first major final between unseeded players in the professional era, and the winner will become the youngest major champion since Maria Sharapova at Wimbledon in 2004. I'm Giles Snyder. NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing the wine world to people's homes with stories on each bottle and wines inspired by NPR shows like Weekend Edition Merlot, available to adults 21 years or older at nprwineclub.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities to break down barriers and prepare all people for success in their jobs and careers as employees or entrepreneurs. More online at kauffman.org.
This is special coverage from Weekend Edition and NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. All morning we've been hearing commemoration ceremonies marking the moments that four flights crashed on September 11, 2001. In New York, ceremonies were held to mark the moment the two flights hit the Twin Towers in Lower Manhattan. 9:37, American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon, then shortly after 10 o'clock, United Airlines Flight 93, having been commandeered by passengers fighting the hijackers, crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Today we've heard the tolling of the bells, moments of silence, followed by a reading of the names of the 2,977 people who perished that day. Just after the 9/11 attacks, President George W. Bush tried to reassure a shocked and terrified nation.
The resolve of our great nation is being tested. But make no mistake, we will show the world that we will pass this test.
So, now 20 years later, did the U.S. passed that test. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has this story.
As President Bush flew back to Washington on Air Force One following those remarks on September 11th, he was accompanied by Michael Morell, the CIA officer who briefed the president daily. Morell was in touch with CIA headquarters, which had given him heart-stopping intelligence that he had to urgently relay to the president.
The message was that what happened that morning was the first of two waves of attacks against the United States.
In the end, there was no second wave. And in the past 20 years, the only deadly attack carried out in the U.S. with a direct link to al-Qaeda was a 2019 shooting by a Saudi Arabian aviation student that killed three people at the Pensacola Naval Air Station. So is the U.S. safer today than 20 years ago? We asked several former officials who served in senior positions over the past two decades. Their collective answer could be summarized as, yes, but...
We are safer. We have done a lot to prevent another major catastrophic attack.
Jane Harman was a Democratic congresswoman from California. A leading member of the House Intelligence Committee, she was walking to the Capitol Dome when the 9/11 news broke.
The dome where I was headed was the intended target of the fourth plane.
The one that crashed in Pennsylvania.
So, you know, this is kind of personal.
She's quick to add that the U.S. response since 9/11 has included many damaging mistakes and considers herself among those responsible.
What we did wrong going forward was we exceeded the mission. The mission was to degrade the ability of al-Qaeda to attack us again. We did that very quickly. But, I mean, we stayed. There was mission creep. We over-militarized our response.
That was in Afghanistan. The other huge misstep, she says, was invading Iraq on the false premise that Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction.
I supported the resolution on Iraq because I believed that intelligence. So that was mistake probably primo number one.
Doug Lute, known as the war czar for Iraq and Afghanistan, was on President Obama's National Security Council. The retired Army Lieutenant General says the U.S. is now safer because of advances in military firepower.
We literally have the ability to strike anywhere in the world almost overnight. We can do it from the air. We can do it from systems launched at sea. We can do it with people on the ground.
But he says the U.S. has inflicted considerable harm on itself for failing to live up to its values at home and abroad.
You see a slippage in democratic values here in the United States. It's hard to refute after witnessing the example of January 6th, but also overseas. I mean, this notion of extreme interrogation measures, a euphemism for torture, certainly that's not in accordance with American values.
Janet Napolitano, who ran the Department of Homeland Security, says the country needs to think more broadly about the definition of national security. Her list now includes
border security, ransomware attack, pandemic, mass shootings, natural disasters, misinformation, disinformation.
In her 2019 book, How Safe Are We?, she defends Homeland Security against critics who consider it an unwieldy bureaucracy, trying to do too many different things. She says the department's many different agencies are needed to deal with threats that keep changing.
The risk environment evolves. It would be virtually impossible for hijackers to take over commercial airliners and weaponize them. On the other hand, risks due to cyber attacks have only continued to increase.
Michael Morrell has now retired from the CIA, but he has a podcast called Intelligence Matters, and he says he still tries to get inside the head of old adversaries. He wonders what Osama bin Laden would think if he were alive today.
I think he would be pretty happy. He would look at the number of extremists in the world today and he would see a number much larger than existed on September 10th, 2001. He would also believe that he had weakened America as a result of the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, not only militarily, but politically.
Yes, Morrell says, we are safer. We passed the test. But we suffered some real damage along the way. Greg Myrie, NPR News.
Time now for StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative. After serving 4 years, former Marine Sergeant Jason Thomas was discharged from active duty in 2000. But he stepped up to serve in another way. A year later, September 11, 2001, his two planes crashed into the World Trade Center just miles from where he lived. He spoke recently over StoryCorps Connect with his youngest son, Jason Christian Thomas, who was born after 9/11, and this was the first time they talked about the details of the day.
So tell me what happened on 9/11.
My mother would always say, you are your brother's keeper and never leave your brother behind. So I grabbed my uniform and I drove into the city. When I got to the World Trade Center, all I could see was other people running in the opposite direction. And they're telling me, go the other way. But as a Marine, I knew that we never go backwards. We always go forward. The ash was so hot. It felt like sandpaper running across my body. And the rubber on the bottom of my boot would sink into the rebar. I would yell down into different crevices of the rubble. This is the United States Marines. Is there anyone down there? Finally, hours later, I got a voice back. I just felt like I was going to die if I went into the hole. It was a very tough decision because your sister was just born and she did not know her dad. But I decided I'm definitely going in. I remember having a camera and taking a couple photos.
We're going to resume our live special coverage now by going to the ceremonies in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that mark where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed, 40 passengers and crew. You've been listening live to some of the ceremonies in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, commemorating the flight there of United Airlines Flight 93. Took off from Newark on its way to San Francisco. Of course, 40 passengers and crew on board. The passengers rose up against the hijackers. And at that point, they knew about the attacks in New York City and the Pentagon. And 40 passengers and crew died when the plane crashed in Shanksville. We're now joined by NPR's Ron Elving and Scott Detrow, who is in Shanksville. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Good morning,
Scott.
Scott Detrow, let me go to you first, because you have gotten to know a number of the families who have, in a sense, gotten to know Shanksville and each other over these last 20 years. What are some of their thoughts today?
20 years is, in some ways, it's not that long at all. In some ways, it's a lifetime ago. You know, one woman who we talked to in our reporting, Debbie Borza, her daughter, Diora Bodley, was 20 years old, and she's really spent a lot of time thinking about the fact that now her daughter has been gone longer than she lived, and that's a really hard thing. Some families who have come to previous anniversaries just felt overwhelmed by the idea of 20 years and are not here, but by and large, a lot of people are here, and it's really a sense of peace and togetherness, and I've seen them greeting each other with big hugs. It's really interesting how over the years this place, this crash site that was the place where their loved ones died in a really terrible way, has become to them a place of remembrance, a place of community, a place of peace. And there's a boulder marking the spot where the plane crashed into the ground. And every year on September 11th, it's the only time any year it opens, there's a gate made of hemlock trees, the hemlocks that the plane crashed into, that opens up, and the family members walk down to the boulder where the plane crashed, and they'll be doing that as soon as the ceremonies conclude today.
I gather, too, over the years, it's become important to the community there. They want to be that place of repose and receive people.
It is. It's this was an abandoned strip mine. That was the phrase you said over and over again in the early days after the attacks. There was a junkyard here, and now, 20 years later, there's a beautiful national park. It's really centered around the wildlife here in the summer. There are wildflowers just dazzling in color in this field, and you can feel the wind. It's up in the mountains. It's a really tranquil, peaceful place, and the community is very proud of it.
NPR's Ron Elving, let me ask you, we are going to be hearing from former President George W. Bush at some point in a few moments in Shanksville. He, of course, was in office at the time of the September 11th attacks. It was really, he'd only been in office, obviously, since January. This is an event that defined his presidency. Some would say he defined it in ways which were unfortunate. Help us understand how what he said and what he did shaped where he took the country thereafter.
Your talk just now of what has happened to the community in Pennsylvania made me think tragedy does create community of a kind, a shared sadness, a shared loss. And what we get from the full picture of the last 20 years, and we've been hearing this from speaker after speaker today, is a sense of the community that was built by the 9/11 tragedies and then lost over the course of the next 20 years. And the tragedy, the personal tragedy, if you will, of George W. Bush is that, as you say, this defined his presidency. Certainly, it gave him his highest moments of public approval and perhaps his highest moments of achievement as a executive of the United States. But it also defined his presidency and defined the last 20 years in the measure of how much we've lost of that unity that we briefly had 20 years ago. And some of that is going to attach historically to George W. Bush as well. And it will be interesting to see how he may speak to that this morning.
Yeah. Scott Detrow, President Bush will speak there in Shanksville. President Biden released a pre-recorded message. Do you have any idea of the reasoning there?
Well, President Biden is going to all three sites today, and the White House was asked, why isn't President Biden giving a keynote speech anywhere? And they said that he wanted to be an observer. He wanted to be
there just watching, and you know, he's making his way to Shanksville later in the day, where he's going to lay a wreath at the Wall of Names. He'll be at the Pentagon at the end of the day. Vice President Harris is here as well, and she's going to be speaking after former President Bush. She's set to speak for about 5 minutes. But yeah, it is notable that the President of the United States, the current President of the United States, is not headlining a ceremony, is not delivering a major speech, especially given the fact that, you know, over the course of the summer, we saw that he was thinking so much about the 20th anniversary of September 11th as one driving factor of ending the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah. And Ron Lavely, let me turn to you. We are reminded 20 years thereafter after the terrible events of September 11th, how these moments do tend to define political leadership, don't they? The Congress as much as whoever was president of the United States at that point and the events that followed.
Yes, this was scarcely what anyone was expecting the Bush years to consist of. This was a time when the Soviet Union had fallen. Vietnam was an increasingly distant memory. The United States had, in some respects, come to think of itself as enjoying a peace dividend. It had been some while since the Iran hostage crisis, and we were focused to a much greater degree on our own notion, complacent as it may have been, of defining ourselves and not worrying that much about the rest of the world, or so we thought. Of course, in many ways, the United States was very much present in the rest of the world and engendering resentment in some places, and this came home to us. And in the last 20 years, of course, we have experienced that in many tragic ways and continue to do so now. I would think at this particular moment, Joe Biden chose to recede and not be the face of 9/11. He is already the face of so much of what's happened in Afghanistan in the recent weeks that he probably thought this was perhaps the most political thing he could do would be to be as small in today's proceedings as possible.
Well, and that touches on a question that I think will be on a lot of minds. President Biden will he now be defined as the president who reached a working agreement with the Taliban and who withdrew American troops, but in ways about which questions are still raised as to how it evinced the loyalty the U.S. owed its Afghan allies.
Well, of course, the agreement to withdraw, that is the agreement with the Taliban with no participation by the Afghan government, mm-hmm. was reached by the previous administration, February of 2020, by the previous Secretary of State and President Trump. They promised we would be out by May 1st, and if the Taliban didn't kill any more of our personnel, we would follow through on that and be out of the country by May 1st. But it is the president who is on watch when a disaster happens, who is remembered in connection with that disaster, and that is something President Biden well understands. Mm.
Scott Tetreault, let me turn to you as someone who has covered a lot of these events politically. President Biden certainly wants to associate himself with the feeling of national unity, but at the same time, it's almost unusual to see a president take this subordinate position in ceremonies like this, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think you and Ron are making good points about the political reasoning of how the Afghanistan withdrawal is played over. But I think this is also something that happened 20 years ago. And mm-hmm. and President Bush, who was making those decisions, who was whisked away on Air Force One and of course, made decisions in the months after 9/11 that have defined this country ever since, maybe makes sense for him to be a key speaker here today looking back. I mean, one thing about 20 years I think that makes it hard is that it's kind of the borderline between something that's really set in history, right? It's not 5 years ago, it's not 10, it's an entire generation beforehand, and maybe the last generation's leaders are the ones who should speak to it that day.
Ron Elving, and I find myself reminded as the 20 years have passed, there was actually a time when Americans believed, and this was even after World War II, that, you know, here the country was poised between two great oceans. And while it certainly became involved in wars, it was somehow not subject to attack.
We thought we chose when we would go to war. Now, of course, Pearl Harbor changed that in 1941. That attack on our base in Hawaii, naval base, was a huge loss of life and a huge shock and defined the rest of the 20th century, really, for Americans. But with that extraordinary exception, we thought it was up to us when we decided to get involved in the rest of the world. We could do it because we wanted to fight communism. We could do it because we wanted to advance the cause of freedom or build nations, as at times we have committed to doing. But we chose. And on 9/11, we learned that that was no longer going to be the case in the 21st century, if indeed it ever really was.
And let me ask you, how much of, it's impossible to foresee, and of course that's why they have elections, but how much of an issue will the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, especially the way in which it was done, the images which are seared into our minds almost as much as people falling from the towers on September 11th, the images of Afghans falling from planes, how much of a political issue will that become even before the next presidential election and the midterm elections that are coming up?
It surely will be an issue. The question is how many other things will be competing with it to be in the forefront of the voters' minds. We know that the pandemic is enormously important to people today, the fate of the economy. I also think that there is some chance that much of how we think about Afghanistan a year from now or 2 or 3 years from now will depend on what happens there next, will depend on just how awful, how horrific images we see from Afghanistan may be. Not to prejudge it in the most negative terms, but there could be further horrors that are going to be extraordinarily difficult for Americans to tune out. And insofar as that is the case, the issue will rise even against such other major issues as the pandemic.
Yeah. You're listening to live special coverage from Weekend Edition and NPR News of the moments and ceremonies to mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. We're with NPR's Ron Elving and Scott Detrow. We are awaiting the appearance of former President George W. Bush, who will speak in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at the site where that morning, shortly after 10:03 Eastern Standard Time, United Airlines Flight 93, which had been bound from Newark Airport in New Jersey to San Francisco, crashed. Of course, it had been overtaken by four hijackers. Passengers and crew fought back. 40 passengers and crew died. And Ron, let me enlist you in this question again. It's very difficult for a president to know what note to strike at a time of national crisis. President Bush, who will speak in a few moments, had extraordinary bipartisan support of the kind we haven't seen since that time.
That's right, because his polls went to 90% approval, yeah. And they had been hovering right around 50 just before 9/11, and his administration had not been an unbroken success, although they had passed some legislation, cut some taxes, and at that particular point, they had just lost control of the Senate because the Senate was very closely divided, and they had just lost a member of the Republican Party who decided to become an independent. So things were not that great for George W. Bush the day before 9/11. But after that, he was the nation's leader. We rallied around the flag. People who disapproved of 4 out of 5 of his policies suddenly found themselves approving of 4 out of 5 of his policies. And all the polls changed in his favor. And, of course, Congress was aware of all of that, and Congress was also aware of the anger and the vengefulness that was moving many American voters, not all, but many American voters at that time. And if you listen to the popular music of the day, if you go back and watch the news coverage of the day, there was a building momentum to make someone pay for what had happened on 9/11.
We remember President Bush appearing of course, at the site of what became known as Ground Zero, I guess it already was then, I guess about a month after the attacks of 9/11, and he said, they will hear you and they will pay. And, of course, that was language that President Biden used. We will hunt them down, they will pay. seemed almost unusual, coming in the words of this president, at the attacks that presented itself at the Kabul airport. To what degree will the world be able to watch what transpires in Afghanistan now, Scott Detrow?
Going forward, I don't know if I'll get to that point, because it looks like former President Bush is about to be introduced here. I can see him shuffling his notes a little, and maybe he's not speaking right in this moment. Going forward, certainly there will be, with Taliban control, there's an open question of how much free media will be able to tell the story of Afghanistan. But the irony in trying to end this 20-year war and ending this 20-year war, there was more international focus on things that were happening in Afghanistan for decades, over the summer. Yeah. The Taliban had been steadily regaining control of Taliban for years and years, but it didn't really gain widespread recognition in the United States until President Biden made that decision, and we saw what happened next. Yes.
I'm told that President Bush is about to speak right now. We can see him on a monitor. He seems to be being introduced, sitting next to Laura Bush. And why don't we just go to the ceremonies and hear the introduction and then the president's speech.
To commemorate the heroes of Flight 93 for signing the act that created this national memorial on September 24th, 2002. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 43rd President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Laura and I are honored to be with you. Madam Vice President, Vice President Cheney, Governor Wolf, Secretary Holland, and distinguished guests. 20 years ago, we all found in different ways, in different places, but all at the same moment, that our lives would be changed forever. The world was loud with carnage and sirens, and then quiet with missing voices that would never be heard again. These lives remain precious to our country and infinitely precious to many of you. Today we remember your loss, we share your sorrow, and we honor the men and women you have loved so long and so well. For those too young to recall that clear September day, it is hard to describe the mix of feelings we experienced. There was horror at the scale of destruction, and awe at the bravery and kindness that rose to meet it. There was shock at the audacity of evil, and gratitude for the heroism and decency that opposed it. In the sacrifice of the first responders, in the mutual aid of strangers, in the solidarity of grief and grace, the actions of an enemy revealed the spirit of a people, and we were proud of our wounded nation. In these memories, the passengers and crew of Flight 93 must always have an honored place. Here, the intended targets became the instruments of rescue, and many who are now alive owe a vast, unconscious debt to the defiance displayed in the skies above this field. It would be a mistake to idealize the experience of those terrible events. All that many people could initially see was the brute randomness of death. All that many could feel was unearned suffering. All that many could hear was God's terrible silence. There are many who still struggle with a lonely pain that cuts deep within. In those fateful hours, we learned other lessons as well. We saw that Americans were vulnerable, but not fragile, that they possess a core of strength that survives the worst that life can bring. We learned that bravery is more common than we imagined, emerging with sudden splendor in the face of death. We vividly felt how every hour with our loved ones was a temporary and holy gift. And we found that even the longest days end. Many of us have tried to make spiritual sense of these events. There is no simple explanation for the mix of providence and human will that sets the direction of our lives. But comfort can come from a different sort of knowledge. After wandering long and lost in the dark, many have found they were actually walking step by step toward grace. As a nation, our adjustments have been profound. Many Americans struggled to understand why an enemy would hate us with such zeal. The security measures incorporated into our lives are both sources of comfort and reminders of our vulnerability. And we have seen growing evidence that the dangers to our country can come not only across borders, but from violence that gathers within. There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdainful pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them. After 9/11, millions of brave Americans stepped forward and volunteered to serve in the armed forces. The military measures taken over the last 20 years to pursue dangers at their source have led to debate. But one thing is certain. We owe an assurance to all who have fought our nation's most recent battles. Let me speak directly to veterans and people in uniform. The cause you pursued at the call of duty is the noblest America has to offer. You have shielded your fellow citizens from danger. You have defended the beliefs of your country and advanced the rights of the downtrodden. You have been the face of hope and mercy in dark places. You have been a force for good in the world. Nothing that has followed, nothing, can tarnish your honor or diminish your accomplishments. To you and to the honored dead, our country is forever grateful. In the weeks and months following the 9/11 attacks, I was proud to lead an amazing, resilient, united people. When it comes to the unity of America, those days seem distant from our own. Malign force seems at work in our common life that turns every disagreement into an argument and every argument into a clash of cultures. So much of our politics has become a naked appeal to anger, fear, and resentment. That leaves us worried about our nation and our future together. I come without explanations or solutions. I can only tell you what I've seen. On America's day of trial and grief, I saw millions of people instinctively grab for a neighbor's hand and rally to the cause of one another. That is the America I know. At a time when religious bigotry might have flowed freely, I saw Americans reject prejudice and embrace people of Muslim faith. That is the nation I know. At a time when nativism could have stirred hatred and violence against people perceived as outsiders, I saw Americans reaffirm their welcome to immigrants and refugees. That is the nation I know. At a time when some viewed the rising generation as individualistic and decadent, I saw young people embrace an ethic of service and rise to selfless action. That is the nation I know. This is not mere nostalgia. It is the truest version of ourselves. It is what we have been and what we can be again. 20 years ago, terrorists chose a random group of Americans on a routine flight to be collateral damage in a spectacular act of terror. The 33 passengers and 7 crew of Flight 93 could have been any group of citizens selected by fate. In a sense, they stood in for us all. The terrorists soon discovered that a random group of Americans is an exceptional group of people facing an impossible circumstance. They comforted their loved ones by phone, braced each other for action, and defeated the designs of evil. These Americans were brave, strong, and united in ways that shocked the terrorists, but should not surprise any of us. This is the nation we know. And whenever we need hope and inspiration, we can look to the skies and remember. God bless.
Thank you, Mr. President, for those beautiful, insightful words.
That, of course, was former President George W. Bush,
you know, President
speaking
Bush
in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at the site
times.
Where 20 years ago this morning, United Airlines Flight 93 crashed, and 40 passengers and crew died. NPR's Ron Elving, I believe you're still with us. He made some interesting... he cited January 6th in a way, didn't he?
There seemed to be a reference there, particularly in referring to the threats to the Capitol from both the airliner that was brought down in Pennsylvania, which U.S. intelligence believed was heading for the Capitol itself. And, of course, we, in our time, think about the threat to the Capitol on January 6th. And this entire speech is going to be mined, I think, and carefully analyzed for the references that he's making. There seemed to be a passing reference to the manner of our final leaving Afghanistan. There seemed to be disapproval for those who have divided the country, particularly with respect to religious prejudice. President Bush saying, at least in the country he knew, people in this country had refused to scapegoat Muslims. I would like to think that that had been as true as he portrayed it this morning. I don't think everyone would agree with that, but this speech will be carefully scrubbed for all the different meanings of all the things that he was referring to. And I think he was appealing here as something of a mea culpa, but mostly as a, I was leading the country I knew and believed in, and if other things have happened, that was not what I intended.
You are listening to live special coverage from Weekend Edition and NPR News of the events commemorating the strikes of September 11th, 2001, as they unfold this morning in New York City and the Pentagon outside of Washington, D.C., and now most recently in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I want to turn to... I'm going to turn openly to our producers now and ask what we have on tap. Well, I want we're going to continue with our program commemorating the attacks of September 11th.
You're listening to special coverage of the 20th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11 on Radio Catskill, your public radio station for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. Special coverage continues with NPR through to noon, and then at noon we'll switch over to some specials produced by some of our partners. We have a special at BBC World Service that's on at noon, talking to some of the families of 9/11 and how they have coped in the years past the attacks. At 1 o'clock, Peace Talks Radio, the people who lost family members in the attacks talk about turning their grief into action for peace. And at 2, an in-depth two-hour feature from the History Channel and WNYC Studios focusing on the decade that led up to the 9/11 attacks. This is WJFF Jeffersonville. It's 11 o'clock.